Being an innovator, laugh a little louder. Don't go at the trader, we can show you how to. When will you be there? You belong to the Mary Marble Marching Society. March along is the song of the Mary Marble Marching Society. If you growl, if you groan, with the dour, sour uncle, if you howl, if you moan, you can lose your sour crust, but you can trim that in step with the thin and up step of the Mary Marble Marching Society.
Be an early riser.
Try to be ambitious.
Speak a little wiser.
Try to be judicious.
Be a good advisor.
Never ever vicious.
And where
will you be then?
Face front! Lift your head! You're on the winning team!
You belong to the Mary Marble Marching Society. March along to the song of the Mary Marble Marching Society. If you growl, if you groan, and your score is nearly zero, do not howl, do not moan, you can be a superhero. Marching right along to the fighting song of the Mary Marble Marching Society. Walk a little prouder, be an innovator, laugh a little louder, go forever greater, we can show you how to.
CITR 101.9 FM, this is the Inkstud Show, the radio show where we talk about comics. Today's guest is, now I hope I got it right, Mark Evanier?
Evanier,
right. Okay. I was corrected a while ago because I'm a Canadian, I was pronouncing it, I think, the en français. Evanier.
But. No one ever gets it right.
How are you doing today?
Fine, sir.
Excellent. Now, you've got a fair amount of work behind you done. You've been doing GRU for, 30 years, probably?
27 years.
Oh, yeah, you just had the 25th anniversary a couple of years ago. One of the longest running, or the, other than Dave Sim and Gerhardt, longest running team on a continuous comic strip viewing.
Well, it fools people who regrew can't count very well, so they don't really know how long we've been doing it.
No, especially GRU himself. I don't even think, can he count?
GRU can count up to about 2. But he has to take off his shoes. He doesn't wear shoes. Well, anyway.
It's him and Roberto, and that's all that matters.
That's right.
Now, your main thing that we're here to talk about today is the wonderful, I guess the best way to describe it is like a coffee table art book of Jack Kirby, the King of Comics.
Yes.
From, who was it from? From Abrams.
Harry kind of, and Abrams publisher.
Kind of their pilot for their new ongoing series of, I guess, art books about comics folk.
Once more, Mr. Kirby is leading the way into a new industry.
There we go. And it's a whole line of stuff that they have coming out. That
yes, they're
really
amazing people over there. And they really, I did this book in part because it was Harry and Abrams. Such a prestigious art book publisher that I thought Jack would like to have been published by the same guys who were publishing Picasso and Constable and such.
Who is probably influential as many of those fine art folks.
Yeah, Picasso drew a lousy Hulk, actually.
He didn't get the purple right in the pants?
He put all the eyes on one side of the head. It was very strange.
That must have made Hulk angry. So I guess we'll start out with telling people about who Jack Kirby was and why he is so important in the comics milieu. Do you want to provide a little?
Well, sure. Jack was in the comic book industry almost from the start. He was when he got in, he was a relative newcomer because he was in the business like a year after everybody else who started it. But he was in essence in the business from almost the beginning, and He very quickly distinguished himself as one of the preeminent artists of the field and creative talents. He was teamed at the time with a man named Joe Simon, a very brilliant artist, writer, editor as well. And the two of them suddenly distinguished themselves as being the team that could produce very special comics. And they were also two of the very few guys early in comics who envisioned comic books as being something more than repasted newspaper strips, which is what the original comic books were. They were
originally
the first comic books were someone took, you know, a bunch of Dick Tracy strips, cut them up into a different page format, and pasted them down. And then the next wave of comic books, when they started doing original stories, were material that kind of looked like that. In fact, in some cases, it was supposed to replicate that. It was supposed to look like strips that you just didn't have in your local town.
Mm-hmm.
And Simon and Kirby, along with Will Eisner and just a few others, were guys who invented the idea that comic books could do more interesting things, that the page lent itself to different design elements, and they were the first guys really to do large panels and panels where the characters leaped out at you and tumbled out at you, and they had an energy in their work, in both the writing and the artwork, that made their work very popular, and they quickly rose to this preeminent position and proceeded to do very innovative comics throughout the 40s and through most of the 50s. They split up around 1957, went their separate ways, and before long, Mr. Kirby was teamed up with a man named Stan Lee at Marvel, and there Jack created or co-created a lot of the Marvel Universe, and once more innovated the entire industry. The comic book business had been faltering, and it was this huge comeback in the 60s that was largely Marvel leading the field and becoming the dominant publisher, and at the core of that was Mr. Kirby and his brilliant visuals and his brilliant ideas for new characters, and by that point he really had established himself in the field. What more do you want me to tell you?
Well, I'll ask some questions. Sure. Specifically about the King. First off, where does the moniker come from?
Well, Stan Lee tended... Well, there's actually a couple of stories of that. One of the very first publishers that Jack worked for when he got into comics was a guy named Victor Fox, who was not the most honest or well-paying publisher in the business. Far from it. Mr. Fox used to refer to himself as the King of the Comics because he was so proud of the fact that his books were selling. They weren't even selling that well, but he had delusions of adequacy. And he called himself the King of the Comics, and the other artists who worked for him would mock him and parody him behind his back, you know, imitating the boss, and they would say, you know, they would all refer to each other as King of the Comics. So it became kind of a joke name. And years later, in the 60s, one of the things, the many innovations of the Marvel Comics, and this was mostly Stan Lee's doing, was the idea of promoting the writers and artists. A lot of people who'd done comics in the past were anonymous or kind of invisible, even if they signed their name to it. And Stan promoted himself and Jack, and he promoted himself and Steve Ditko, who was doing Spider-Man. And he gave them a lot of them nicknames. He started calling himself Stan the Man Lee. And to come up with something corresponding, when his name was next to Jack's, he started calling Jack King Kirby. And at first, Jack thought it was very funny because, you know, all of a sudden he's usurping Victor Fox's old nickname. But eventually, so many people were calling him that he kind of rolled with it and went along with it. And as long as they didn't take it too seriously, he was proud to be called the King.
Now, how did you get introduced to Jack?
Well, I'd followed his work as a reader. I was a devout comic book reader almost from birth. I tell people that when I was born and the doctor slapped me, I dropped a copy of Walt Disney's Comics and Stories. But I read comic books for years, and in the 60s I had this comic book club in Los Angeles. We billed ourselves as the largest comic book club in the world because we just didn't know of a bigger one. It was about 40, 50 guys, and we'd meet on Saturday at a public park, and we would... like a mini comic convention, we'd trade comics and sell, and we'd argue. We had a lot of debates and arguments and things about it and discuss them. And I was the president. And in 1969, Jack and his wife, Roz, had moved to Southern California. The comic book industry was very New York-based for most of its existence, and in 1969, it was kind of unheard of for a guy working for DC and Marvel to live outside commuting distance of Manhattan. But Jack moved out here, and he and his wife decided that they wanted to start meeting some of the local fans and artists and things. They went to a science fiction convention on their own, and they met some of our club's officers. I was not there, but they met them. They went, oh, here's the people interested in comics, and they invited the officers of our club down to the Kirby House, which was at that time located in Irvine, California, which is an hour and a half south of Los Angeles. And I was part of that group since I was the president of the club, and I got along well with Jack. I showed him some of my amateurish work that I was doing at the time. He was impressed with it. He recommended me for a job on a Marvel-related project at the time, which I got, and he was impressed with the work I did on that. And in early 1970, he left Marvel over a contract dispute, went to D.C., and decided that for the projects that were then possible, he might need some assistance. So he hired myself and a fellow named Steve Sherman, who was working with me at the company where I was employed, and we became his assistants for a few years. And as I always hasten to tell people, contributed darn near nothing to the published work. So many people over the years have taken credit for Jack's work, that I feel it behooves us to bend over backwards to make clear that we were not ghosting his work or even making a substantial contribution to it.
You were the coffee guys.
My big contribution was Jack would tell us you know, the idea that he had coming up for the next issue, and I would say, hey, Jack, that's great. or I'd say, hey, you should bring that character back. Or, I mean, I did a little things. I wrote a few little outlines, a few little things here and there, a few pages here, and they let me write. And I did some little bit of art production, you know, the mechanical stuff where artwork had to be moved or pasted up or whatever. Mm-hmm. Emily and Steve and I wrote the letter pages and stuff like that. But it really was work that anyone could have done.
Yeah,
it was not a. I would be embarrassed to claim it as a credit. but we got to hang out with Jack for and listen to the stories and see how his mind worked, and we became close, and it was just a wonderful association. It never yielded much money, but it was the most profitable association I've ever had in my life.
Mm-hmm. Like, one could only imagine being around someone so creative and kind of just a omnipresent figure for so long. Now, when you started doing the book, what was the intention that you had? Because this is only one of two Kirby projects you've got.
Yeah, well, I've written a mammoth biography of Jack, a huge, huge, way too long probably to publish biography of Jack, which is still growing because I'm still finding out new things about him. And I'm going to publish it one of these days, maybe the next couple years.
How does it compare to R.C. Harvey's Milton Caniff
biography? It makes R.C. Harvey's Milton Caniff book look like a pamphlet. No, it's probably about the same length or a little bigger at this point. I don't know. I don't know how long it's going to be. And I have to go back, and there's way too much detail about some things I've got to trim out or whatever. I've actually been thinking of publishing it in two editions, one for human beings who want to read it and one for people who want to know what Jack had, you know, on his cheeseburger in August of 1957. Because I got to that level of detail.
And you know what? There are people that'll be very happy to know.
Yes. So I might publish the obsessive Kirby fan edition. I don't know yet. I'm just going to kind of let the material take its form. And people have been asking me, when's the book coming out? When's the book coming out? And I kept saying soon, soon. And I realized there was this void in the marketplace, that the world was hungry to read something about Jack from me. And the people at Harry and Abrams came to me, and they said, we would love to have a big Jack Kirby book. This had actually been suggested by one of the heads of Barnes & Noble.
Oh, wow.
He suggested to them that there was this void and that they get me to fill it, and specifically named me. I happen to already know the people at Abrams, or some of them. A fellow named Charlie Kochman, who is one of the senior editors there. I think he's now the senior editor. I worked with Charlie when he was at the book division of DC Comics. I did a book on Mad Magazine for him over there called Mad Art, on the history of Mad. And Charlie came to me and said, how about we put this book out? And I thought, well, first of all, it's Abrams, which is a prestigious company. You can't do better. I mean, there are some wonderful publishers out there, but you can't do any better than Abrams in terms of quality control and the name of the company's position in the marketplace. When I've said to certain booksellers, it's coming out from Harry and Abrams, that took it into a different category of impressive people. And also, I just thought, you know, these are people I like working with, and like I said, Jack would like to have been in their catalog as opposed to being in the
a
catalog of a company that only does comic books or that does stuff specifically for the niche market, whereas, you know, Abrams has gotten it in bookshops. My mother, when she was at, my mother's in a wheelchair, and her caregiver took her someplace, and she said, this is when the book first came out, she said, oh, wheel me over to the Barnes & Noble down the other end of the mall. I want to see if they have my son's book. And the caregiver wheeled her down there and wheeled her in, and it was the first week the book was on sale, and they had a big display of it near the front of the store, and my mother was so happy.
Nice.
So, you know, that's a real nice thing.
Yeah.
But also, I like the idea of Jack being in that mainstream environment as opposed to being just in comic book shops, not that there's anything wrong with comic book shops, but the story of Jack Kirby is the story of someone who influenced more than just Marvel and DC Comics.
Yeah.
And he influenced quite a few people who had nothing to do with comic books in a direct manner, but who grew up on his work and were inspired to become filmmakers or actors or painters. I hear from so many people whose work would not suggest to you a Kirby connection, but there is one to them, they seek me out frequently. And that's one of the great things about doing this book, by the way, is I've become this nexus for people who are interested in Jack Kirby, and they come to me and tell me they're Kirby. I love talking about Jack. He's the most fascinating person I've ever encountered, and I feel very fortunate that I can share what I know about him with other people. You can't keep something like that all to yourself.
It's interesting, right now it seems like there seems to be even larger amount of Kirby available and a whole new renewed interest among a whole new generation of folks, too.
I have an amazing cottage industry going, writing the forewords for reprints of Jack's work. and there's not a lot, again, once again, there's not a lot of money in it, but it's something I love doing.
Yeah.
And before this year is out, I will have written forewords for 5 different publishers putting out Kirby material. And I tell people this, and it seems to mean something to them. I think within the next 5 years, and maybe sooner than that, we will have had just about everything Jack ever did brought into print again,
mm-hmm.
with the exception of a few things that are really so obscure nobody could possibly miss them, and a few things that have licensing problems because of the properties are owned.
It's like Alex Toth's Hot Wheels will never see print.
It might. You'd be surprised. But Jack did a series for Marvel of 2001. He adapted mm-hmm. the movie, and then he did a spinoff series. That might not make it out to print, but not because there's no demand for it. That's the thing. That's the key point. If it doesn't come out, it won't be because anybody thought no one would buy it.
It's just
so... come out because there's a complication in the rights to the material. Marvel will put out everything, and they're in the process of putting out everything Jack ever did for them. DC is in the process of putting out everything he ever did for them. There is this incredible demand, even for material of his, which at the time it came out was regarded as a failure. Now it's a success. I just did the foreword for a collection of a book he had called OMAC for DC. The book just came out
mm-hmm.
a couple months ago. At the time it came out, OMAC was not highly regarded either critically or in terms of as a sales success. It was kind of a flop on every count. Yet books that were then considered successful are not being reprinted, and OMAC is. What does it tell us?
Where's the Sandman reprint?
It'll all get there. You mean the 60s, the 70s Sandman strip that Jack did, the one he did in the 70s? Or the 40s?
Either of them would be lovely to see.
The 40s, what is coming.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's a matter of not saturating the marketplace.
Yeah.
DC people feel they can put out a Kirby book every X months. And every time I go back to New York, I sit down with them, and they get my opinion, and then they do whatever they want. But they're doing a reprint collection of a strip he did called Losers, which is called Our Fighting Forces. That's the next thing. And in a couple of months, we'll decide what comes after that, or they'll decide, and I'll just make my suggestions.
And then Demons
coming out.
Demons coming out, too, I think, soon, isn't it?
Yes, the Demons is the next one to come out, and the Our Fighting Forces follows that. In fact, I know what it is, because I wrote the foreword for the Demons.
Well, I'm gonna...
I do so many of these, I can't keep track of them.
No, it's quite incredible. I mean, he... and I can't remember if it's him or Tezuka has more pages, but both of them are... just incredibly versatile.
Well, prolific and versatile. I think Tezuka has more pages, but it isn't even quantity with Jeff. There were a few people who actually produced more comic pages in their lifetime than he did. I don't think anyone produced more that are treasured and remembered than he did.
The neat thing about the book is you look. You've managed to include a lot of original pages and then compare them with the printed version, and it's the level in his penciling is just so interesting and complex that how much work has gone into a page. But meanwhile, he'll do like five of those in a day.
Sometimes, yeah, he was capable of that. One of the things people don't understand sometimes about Jackie, there's a lot written about how fast he was. He was very fast. He was one of the fastest artists who ever lived in comics. But his lifetime output was also a function of hard work.
Mm-hmm.
One of the many things I learned from Jack was, not to say I always apply it as much as I should, is a phenomenal work ethic.
Yeah.
Jack would go to the drawing table each day around noon, 1 o'clock, and he would sit there till about 4 a.m. Sometimes longer, he'd forget his wife. He had this wonderful wife named Roz, who took wonderful care of him and just protected him. And Jack was in many ways a two-person operation, even though she didn't draw any of the stories.
She was the rock.
She was responsible for them getting done because she took care of him. She dressed him, fed him, and frequently she would wake up in the morning at 6 a.m. and look over and see that Jack's half of the bed was empty. And she'd put on her robe and stagger down the hall, and he'd be sitting there drawing a page or something, and she'd go, "Come to bed, Kirby." And she'd drag him. She'd just like order him into bed, and he'd go. He'd lose all track of time. Jack loved his work. I mean, he didn't necessarily like working those hours, but he did love what he did. And I think that shows in the work, but it's that devotion to sitting there hour after hour after hour is part of the function of this staggering output he had. And yeah, he did sometimes able to do 5 pages a day. And 5 good pages, that's the thing.
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that you look at a Jack Kirby page and you don't really see toss-aways. Like, you see a lot of people putting out pages now, and it's like, someone photocopied a panel there. And one thing I'm wondering about Jack Kirby's, I guess, work ethic is... how much of that was influenced by his growing up?
A lot of it was completely was influenced by that. Jack grew up in the crummy part of New York in a family that was always out of money, and at a very early age, they shoved him out of the door and said, "Go out and earn some money." And he went out and started delivering newspapers and painting signs and doing little messenger jobs at a very early age, because and that was instilled in him. It was a very common thing for kids in his neighborhood, kids of his ancestry, kids of his generation, Depression era kids. And his whole life, Jack was all about doing great comic books and great stories. But his number one thing that he was about was providing for his family.
What would have influenced Jack as far as his own reading when he was growing up?
Well, the pulps. Jack was a product of the pulp magazines, newspaper strips, movies. He'd go to the movie house and just sit there all day seeing the same movie over and over again. His mother would at some point go, "It's time for dinner." She'd walk down to the movie house and she'd say to the usher, "Okay, go get him." And the usher knew exactly which kid she was talking about, and Usher would go in and say, "You know, hey, your mom's outside," and Jack would go, "Okay, I just want to see this one scene again." And that was a big thing in his life. And the pulp magazines, he loved pulp. He had in his garage when I worked for him in the 70s, he had these old pulp magazines, a couple hundred of them, maybe a thousand of them, ratty, falling apart, moldy, mildewed, and he loved them. He just somehow just loved just paging through them because they reminded him of this, of that era when everything was possible. And I have no doubt that an awful lot of the ideas that Jack brought into comics, he brought from the pulps and certainly from movies as well.
I'm going to do a quick song break.
All right.
We're about half past. I'm going to play one of the old Mad songs off the old Mad album, since you did work on a Mad book and did all the grooves with Sergio. And then we'll be right back. Right. And it's Inkstud CITR 101.9 FM. CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstud Show, the radio show where we talk about comics. That was off the wonderful 60s album Fink Along with Mad Neighborhood Draft Board. I'm talking to Mark Evanier. Not Evanier. 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 There we go. I almost had it. I'm sorry.
All right.
We're talking about Kirby, King of Comics, book from Abrams. Now, Kirby did some military time during World War II.
Yes, a very life-changing part of Jack's life. He talked about it the rest of his existence. There's a comic book artist named Doug Wildey. He was a friend of ours. And if Wildey walked into a room and Kirby was there, Wildey would start yelling, "No World War II stories! No World War II stories!" He just got fed up with Jack always talking about World War II. It was a very big moment in Jack's life, and he used it in a lot of his work. and I don't mean just work when he was drawing and writing comics about World War II. He used emotions from that period and fears, and when Jack had to reference moments of crisis in his work, get in touch emotionally with what something felt like, he would usually go back to World War II and remember what it felt like back then.
And he, kind of going along with the Neighborhood Draft Board thing, he was against the Vietnam War, from what I understand.
Yes, very much so.
And the comic you were mentioning earlier that's getting reprinted in the, I guess, in January, The Losers, was kind of a commentary on that, wasn't it?
Well, The Losers was a book that was created by a writer named Robert Kaniger, a DC writer, mainstay for some time. And Kaniger and Kirby did not like each other. And Kirby was kind of assigned to this book, kind of against his wishes. I can't think of anything Jack would less have named a strip about World War II characters than The Losers. But that was the name he was stuck with. And he crafted his own stories about it. And I don't think he was writing specifically about Vietnam. Jack was a big picture kind of guy. He always looked at everything in terms of the context of the entire universe, no matter what he was doing. In fact, when you talk to Jack, he would frequently, whatever topic you were on, he would take it bigger always. He would always try to fit it into the great cosmos. And I think he saw all war as kind of one war on a certain level. And so you could, if you wrote about any war, you were writing about all wars. There are certain common things. There probably are certain reference points in The Losers where you can point to certain things and say this was because of Vietnam. But however, Jack was doing The Losers in the mid-70s, by which time Vietnam was dying out as an issue. If he had done it a few years earlier, it probably would have been more Vietnam-specific. It was probably a little more of Vietnam and the Forever People, which he did in 1970,
mm-hmm.
than there was in The Losers strip.
And that was Vietnam, but it was also really focused on the youth.
Yes. Yeah. Jack was very conscious of youth and very, very helpful. Not everyone who was in comics in the 70s and had spent their whole life in it was that thrilled about new kids getting into the field. Jack was enormously happy with it, and he helped so many different people, not just me and my friends, but anybody who came to him got encouragement and whatever he could do to help their careers along. He was completely non-competitive that way, and he loved the idea of new talent coming into comics and new people doing comics. And people, mostly people bringing in new things. He discouraged people who wanted to get into comics and replicate what he had done.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's a story I tell about Jack frequently, which seems to strike a bell with people. One time when Jack was not working for Marvel, I showed him a fanzine where some kid had said he was taking over, I think it was Captain America. And he said, "I'm going to do stories in the Kirby tradition." Jack looked at it and said, "The kid doesn't get it. The Kirby tradition is to create a new comic."
Now, just going a little bit back in the war thing, one quick question is, what did he think of Harvey Kurtzman's war comics?
I'm not sure he ever read them. He liked Harvey Kurtzman personally and respected him. Jack liked just about everybody in comics.
Mm-hmm.
Unless, they'd done something really awful to him, which a few people had.
Yeah.
But even then, he was Jack was very non-competitive. He generally didn't look at other people's comics very much. He respected anybody who could do something that had the following. I don't think he ever sat down and read what Kurtzman did, but he was certainly aware of it, and he certainly liked Harvey and vice versa. I had lunch one time with Harvey and Jack, and they just, I was just sitting there saying nothing, eating a hot turkey sandwich while these guys kept praising each other across the table.
Two humble, great figures.
And two guys who both shared a certain feeling that they had not received rewards commensurate with their contribution.
Mm-hmm.
They were both, bitter is too strong a word, but both very conscious of the fact that they had not, that their work had made a lot of money for other people.
Well, they both came from under the shadows of, I guess, egos, powerful egos.
They were both guys who wanted to do something wonderful in comics and to make the business thrive. They had some differences of approaches, obviously, and of style.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, interestingly, this is not generally known, but when Kurtzman was doing Little Annie Fanny in the 60s for Playboy, he approached Jack and he said, "How about drawing some of doing some of the artwork on Little Annie Fanny, and let's create a new strip for Playboy, which I'll just write and you draw." Kirschner had in mind something like a Barbarella type strip, some science fiction strip, mm-hmm. lots of naked women prancing about. And Jack declined the entire offer. He was you know, pleased that he'd been asked, because he was always pleased when people sought him out. But he just felt it wasn't his type of material. That, you know, he kept saying, "I got three daughters. I can't draw that." But he respected Kurtzman tremendously.
Now, Kirby, how was it in the 70s for him, the transfer to New York, from New York to California? Was that really a chance for him to explore his own style? Like, because you see quite a transformation when he starts doing The New Gods.
Well, the transformation with The New Gods was he was at a new publisher. He was no longer working with Stan Lee. He was able to write material completely himself as opposed to contributing to the plots and such. They have this whole method of doing comics, the Marvel method, where the artist pencils something out and the writer puts in the dialogue afterwards, which had been very successful, obviously, in many applications. It had stopped working for Jack. He wasn't happy with working that way with anyone, with mm-hmm. Stan. He just felt that he was a writer. He was being asked to write the comic without credit or money, and then to let someone else rewrite it, which meant that his work was being altered, sometimes in ways that bothered him, thematically or in terms of content. So he was very thrilled that he finally had the opportunity to write what he was the story and have it reach the readers in roughly the form that he had in mind. So that was different. Being a new publisher was different. He had moved to California a few months earlier before when he went to D.C. He'd been in California about 8 months, and it was a very strange time because here he was the preeminent artist in the field, the highest paid artist in the field, which unfortunately didn't mean that much, and he was kind of starting over at an age when somebody else might have, in his mid-50s, he was starting over again, mm-hmm. and a new publisher having to prove himself again very difficult situation. The DC Comics of 1970 was a company in enormous trouble for reasons that had nothing to do with Jack. But newsstands were going away. They were selling their comics on newsstands, and the newsstand market was shrinking with every passing month. And there was the comics were being distributed by a company called Independent News, which was also owned by DC. And Independent News had lost faith in comics. The people who were distributing the comics were saying, "Well, the business will die out soon. We won't be distributing comics much longer." And that was the environment in which Jack suddenly found himself. One of the things that was always key about Jack, that separated him from his other writers and artists of his era, of the entirety of comics, is this. You know, everyone wants to do a good comic. They hire you tomorrow. You're going to want to do something that will be successful and wonderful, that people will love it. And of course, that Jack always did. Most people just think, "I'm going to do this comic." Jack always looked on his personal responsibility as saving the industry and innovating the industry. He was not satisfied ever to come in and just do one comic that people liked. He looked at this big picture idea I talked about. When he went to DC in 1970, he felt, "I've got to save DC Comics and therefore the whole industry. I've got to come up with something brand new, new formats, new ideas." And he found that DC was, particularly the independent news people, were kind of resistant to that. So it was not a great environment for him. He didn't feel they were letting him do what he did best. And he didn't feel that they were willing to accept all the stuff he was giving them, even though they were well aware the business was in trouble. He was very frustrated that business people at DC Comics and Independent News would tell you unabashedly the business is crashing. He'd say, "Well, here's something to do to arrest that and maybe save it," and they wouldn't listen to him. They wouldn't listen to anybody. They were going to let the business just crash and burn. And of course, that didn't happen, but it came darn close for a while there.
Now, for folks that haven't really read much Jack Kirby stuff, What would you suggest are maybe three or four must-reads?
Well, you know, Marvel has reprinted in many, many formats the first 100 issues of Fantastic Four that Jack did with Stan. When I get asked this question, I tell people, you know, that material is available in a number of different formats. You can buy it on CD-ROM, you can buy it in paperback, you can buy it in hardcover. If you read that, you don't fall madly in love. There's almost no point in looking at anything else. DC has reprinted all the New Gods material, the Fourth World series.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little high-priced, the hardcover books. You know, there's nothing wrong with that either. It's very strong material. A little harder to access for a new reader. You've got to. It's not an entry level comic book. It's something you've got to kind of understand comics.
I got to say, I'm not very happy with the format of the the issues being published in the reprints.
Really? What's bothering you?
I would rather read like the New Gods as the New Gods, and then the Forever People as Forever People, and Mr. Miracle instead of reading an issue of Jimmy Olsen and an issue of New Gods. And...
Well, they have been in the past printed mm-hmm. individual books.
In
this
the
time
black...
they said let's put them out in the order they were supposed to be read, because when they came out, Forever People came out, and then 2 weeks later New Gods came out, and then 2 weeks later Mr. Miracle came out. So if you were following the series at that time, this is the order you would have read them in.
Is that how he intended, this developing universe to be?
Yes, yeah, that was exactly how it was intended. If you buy the books, you can read the stories in any order you want.
No, I know.
It's not compulsory.
Someone standing behind me, poking me.
Yeah, anyway, to finish answering your question, there are some reprints coming out next year of Simon and Kirby's best material, Black Magic, Fighting American Boys Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful material, and I would recommend that to anyone. What else? DC. I mean, there's so much Kirby stuff out there. But I tend to think if you read those first 100 Fantastic Fours, and that does, either you'll run out and try to buy everything Jack ever did for Marvel, or you should probably look for another artist to follow.
Or another industry.
Yeah.
Now, Fighting American, that was one of the odder superhero things at the time.
Yes.
Tell people about some of the villains featured and why were they
the strange thing about that was it was a comic done at a time of panic because the industry was doing poorly.
Mm-hmm.
There was this horror comic scare, the one that put EC Comics out of business and many other publishers, and Simon and Kirby were trying to come up with something that would sell. And they decided to try what I guess in the early stages was kind of a knockoff of Captain America, an imitation of their biggest hit. But Mad Magazine was getting big at the time. It was one of the few things that was selling. And also, doing something that seemed like the old Fighting American, the old Captain America stories, seemed stale. So they turned it into a parody. They started putting in silly elements. And it didn't go very well. The books didn't sell, but then nothing was selling at the time. But they had this character named this Russian guy named Yusha Live So Long. They had and Rhode Island Red. They had this very fat villain who rolled places called Round Robin. they just put in these very bizarre, colorful villains, kind of Dick Tracy-esque villains in a
mm-hmm.
way, but funnier, just to see what would happen. I think. One of the great things about comics is that, for the most part, they're done very fast. You don't spend a lot of time with meetings. One of the reasons Jack produced so much work over the years is that there wasn't a lot of planning that went into it. If literally, the publisher would call Jack and say, like when he was working for DC, they'd call him and say, okay, do another issue of Commandy next.
Yeah.
He would sit down and just start doing an issue of Commandy. He wouldn't spend 4 days thinking what it was going to be about. He would start drawing page one, or wherever he started. Sometimes he started in the middle. Within an hour,
mm-hmm.
He'd get the idea and go do it. And it was drawn very fast. And that energy has a lot to do with why the work is exciting. When I used to teach improv comedy for a while, and I discovered as I was teaching it and telling the students the basic premises of improv comedy that I realized I was describing a lot of things about comics. This act of creating on the fly and kind of thinking while doing, and the energy and taking that energy of creation and putting it into the work that way, that's a lot of why Jack's work is exciting. Because it was drawn fast, it was drawn forcefully. He had to get to the point fast. He was doing a fight scene. He had to go for maximum impact quickly. He couldn't. There was not a lot of time there for nuance and subtlety. Although there was enormous amounts of subtext in everything he did because he was a very deep thinker.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, some of the best comics ever done have been done fast. Things that people wrote and drew very quickly, and it seems to have. It's not a coincidence.
Now, talking about that, you know, the impacting fight scenes, one of my favorite Kirby things that I discovered from your book, The Street Code, one of my cartoonist friends was describing it as, like, basically the New Gods meet life in, the early 20th century in New York, just how explosive and just how powerful it all is, the simple little fights between a couple of young ruffians and stuff. What was it about that story that, like, for me, it's just so incredible?
You're talking about is called Street Code. It's one of the last complete stories Jack did, one of the few things he ever did that was published from his pencil art.
Mm-hmm.
It was pure Kirby, apart from somebody else lettering it and a couple of us doing little minor technical cleanups on the art here and there. There's nobody else on the page but Jack Kirby. A publisher named Richard Kyle, a very bright man, old friend of mine, approached Jack. He'd met Jack at conventions over the years and heard Jack tell all these wonderful stories about World War II and all these wonderful stories about growing up in the crummy part of New York. And Richard was publishing a magazine at the time, and he had just enough money in the budget to commission a 10-page Kirby story. And he said, Jack, I want you to forget about doing Marvel Comics and DC Comics. Just to tell us a story. Pick a story from your past. World War II, street gang, whatever you want, and just give us a story. And Street Code is what came out, and I printed the entire story in my book. Richard managed to dig out the original negatives. The story had never had this quality of printing before.
Mm-hmm.
That we suddenly now had with Abrams, and we dug out the original negatives, and we did some restoration work on them, and we printed the story off them, because at first I was going to take a page of it, and I thought, well, you can't take a page out of this thing. It's such a powerful story, and it tells about Jack's upbringing so much more vividly than I could in my
mm-hmm.
text, no matter how much space I took, and it gives people a chance to see this raw Kirby pencil art, and it's not the most ideal period of Jack artistically, because he was having eye problems and he was having a series of small strokes in his drawing hand.
Mm.
So there are some problems he had just drawing what he saw in his brain. And that's like I said, it's one of the last things he did without a lot of assistance. But it was just this amazing masterwork created late in life, and Jack's wife Roz thought it was her favorite story he'd ever done, and she kept a big page of it, the double spread, framed on her wall for years because it reminded her of Jack. It was such a terrific statement of what he was all about. So I just had to include it, and there are people who told me they bought the book just for that story.
Well, I can't blame them. For Jack himself, what were some of his more favorite creations?
Jack liked everything he did. No, that was the thing. People always say to me, what did he like best? Did he like doing superheroes? Did he like doing war stories? He liked doing anything. He liked telling stories. He liked, he was perfectly happy when they had him doing westerns. He was perfectly happy when they had him doing ghost stories. He was very happy doing romance stories, which some artists are not. It's interesting, some artists who do like drawing romance stories only like it because it's an excuse to just draw pretty girls all
yeah.
the time. And Jack liked drawing pretty girls, but that wasn't the appeal for him. The appeal for him was that he was drawing these dramatic things about people, these confrontations about people that he'd observed. And I don't mean he was just doing his friends or his family, whatever the stories, because you couldn't find a direct connection, but Jack could. And he was very proud of certain things he did. He was very proud of the New Gods up to the point where it got terminated before completion. He did a story in the New Gods called The Pact, which was for a long time his favorite thing. I think Street Code took over the honor later, but for a long time, if you asked Jack, what's your favorite thing you've ever done in comics, he would have said The Pact. He loved a book he did in the 50s called Boys Ranch, particularly a story called Month of Delilah that was in one issue. He loved Fighting American. He loved Bullseye, Black Magic, and then, you know, a lot of the Marvel stuff, with particular emphasis on the stories that were most autobiographical to him, which are generally the ones where the lead hero has a cigar.
What kind of cigar did he enjoy smoking?
Roytans. Cheap ones. People would bring Jack good cigars as gifts, and he was very grateful for them, and he smoked them, but when he had to buy them for himself, he bought kind of cheap ones. Jack stopped smoking cigars around 1981. He had a heart bypass, and you know, not a good idea to smoke cigars after that.
No.
But it was interesting that nobody noticed. His heart bypass was kept a secret. A few of us were pledged to secrecy about it. He didn't want people to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody was told about it. It never appeared in print anywhere that he'd had this. It was not generally known. But he stopped smoking cigars, and no one noticed. It was such a part of his personality that I would read, like, someone would write a convention report, and they'd say, yeah, and Kirby was there with his big cigar as always. And I'd go, no, he had no cigar in his there was no cigar there. And he would say, I could have sworn there was a cigar there. I had a friend who, I told this to, and he swore to me that he had a photo of Jack smoking a cigar at a convention in the late 80s. And I said, no, he didn't. And he said, yes, I did. And he ran, and he got the photo. He said, yeah, there's a cigar. Oh, wait a minute. I could have sworn there was a cigar in this photo. But he'd given them up, and no one knew. And people kept giving him cigars, which he said thank you and
pass along.
Threw them away or gave them to somebody else, I guess. Maybe Roz smoked them. I don't know. But Mike Royer, who inked a lot of Jack stuff in the 70s, has these wonderful stories about opening up a package of artwork that he was going to work on. You know, the jacket, you know, being hit in the face with the aroma of Roytan cigars. And Mike got hooked on them. He started smoking them because of his association with Jack. Mike will tell you the one bad thing that Jack ever did for him was he got him hooked on cigars for a while.
And Roy, he was one of his preferred inker near the
end. He was the one that Jack tried to always hire in the 70s and 80s whenever he could.
I was reading that just on the trip up here from home on the bus. Now, just, I guess, we're nearing the end of our time slot. One feature of a lot of his comics is he places himself, parts of himself and his life in that.
Yeah, I think there's a part of Jack in almost everything he ever drew. Sometimes it's hard to make the connection. It's hard to see where it is, but it's in there someplace.
And I guess the prime example is the Thing from Fantastic
Four. Thing was very much like Jack. Nick Fury was very much like Jack. It's interesting, as I reread old Kirby work, every time I read an old Kirby story, I see more of Jack in it. And I suddenly go, why didn't I notice that before? I've read this comic 20 times. Why am I just now noticing the Kirby reference or the Kirby phrase or the Kirby parallel in it? They keep popping up. It's like somebody's secretly rewriting and redrawing my comics, so I'm not looking at them.
It's a subtle. Yeah. Leaving it for a long time for people to figure out, and I think that's the trademark of a great storyteller.
Yeah, well, his stories work on so many different levels. That's one of the reasons I think that they have endured, and why they keep getting reprinted, and why people don't want to turn loose of them. I know people have this, you know, they have their Kirby shelf or two in their house. They have all the reprints, and they have it, this little treasure trove, and they might get rid of all their other comics, but they're going to keep those things to read over and over again.
I have an issue of Boy Commandos from the original run that's signed that I found on eBay somehow.
A fine book.
And it's definitely a gem in my collection.
Yes, good.
It's got the rag guy on the cover. And it's It's a beautiful piece, and I think everyone should take the time to hunt down and find their own little Kirby gem to keep to themselves. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mark.
Anytime. Glad to be of service.
And I look forward to... any other Kirby nuggets you're able to get people to pay attention to?
There'll be a lot of them.
Oh,
thank you.
I can just imagine. Have a swell day, and thank you so much for joining us.
Bye.
Bye. That was Mark Evanyar talking about Jack the King Kirby, his wonderful book from Abrams Books. It is really incredible. I was blown away just by the amount of work that's gone into this. It's such a compendium of completeness of understanding who Jack Kirby was. There's enough biographical information to really learn a lot about him and learn about the artwork. And I think everyone should check it out, as I say every week, but I mean it this time. I mean it every week. I don't know. Up next is Crimes and Treasons. And just so folks know what's going on in future Ink Studs, next week I'll be airing an interview I'm doing tomorrow with Paul Gravett, whose new book, The Mammoth, collection of crime comics, as well as he has another thing coming out. And I forget the name of it right now. And over the next while, we'll be featuring interviews with Jesse Recklaw will be on next month. And some other fine folks, as well as I just spoke with Sean Tan this week. Did a little interview with him while he's in town for the Writers Festival. And actually, I think he might be done his events. But him and Mariko Tamaki, who I also was able to speak with, were doing events this week in Granville Island. And who else? I got a bunch of stuff. And be sure to keep checking out. We'll be doing some little small changes to the Inkstud site coming up soon. I'm going to try. I've got someone who write some really nice reviews. I was really impressed with the reviews that she'd written on her own website, so those are going to be popping up pretty soon. Check out the site for more info, as well as I think Austin English might be joining in and doing some interviews on location in the East Coast. So we'll see if we can get that happening. Till then, keep rocking, y'all.